Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, April 21st. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, that 420 feeling. Locals celebrate Mother Murphy's 5 years of legalized weed from Normal. Pizza for breakfast is not uncommon for a college student. So when 21-year-old Cassandra Chandler Haig, a junior at Augustana College in Rock Island, visiting home in the Twin Cities, had a few slices Sunday morning, no one batted an eye. Until, that is, her parents told her it was a weed pizza. "I quit smoking weed, honestly, and this was a 420 miracle," she said. April 20th, or simply 420, is celebrated annually as a sort of unofficial holiday for users of marijuana. Sunday afternoon, Chandler Haig and her older sister Aspen were shopping at Mother Murphy's, a local glass shop that sells weed paraphernalia and one of their favorite places in Normal. "Oh, it's beautiful. It's such a vibe. Literally a vibe," Aspen Chandler Haig said at the head shop that has been a staple of Bloomington Normal counterculture for more than 50 years. The local head shop held a multi-day sale beginning Friday in honor of 420. But the sale was also a way to draw foot traffic as the prices of everyday goods squeezes small businesses. Earlier in April, the owners posted on Facebook asking for community support as they look to realign the store to get back to our roots and build the head shop you deserve. The response was overwhelmingly positive, said Colton Walsh, one of the three co-owners, along with Griffin Burns and Noah Anderson. "The outpouring of support that we received really just feels incredible," Welsh said on Saturday. The three friends had been patrons of Mother Murphy's for years when in December 2019, they heard the owners were looking to sell. "They had, you know, suits from Chicago and all manner of people that knew the name, knew the place, knew that it had been there forever. And so we were just like, we're going to throw our hats into the ring." At the time, Welsh was living in the Pacific Northwest. He had been visiting home for the holidays and talking with Griffin and Anderson about possibly purchasing the shop. "We went to them and said, hey, we're just some local kids. We grew up here. We've been coming here for years. We love the place. We don't want to see it go to be or do anything other than what it has always done." To our collective surprise, their offer was accepted in early January 2020, basically a three-week span of time between hearing about it for the very first time to they accepted our offer and we're getting the place. "That was just probably among the craziest extreme things that I've ever done in my whole life." On Saturday, Charleston resident David Vanderport was visiting his daughter, who attends Illinois State University, and shopping at Mother Murphy's. They were buying T-shirts printed with posters of the film Reefer Madness on them in honor of 420. "I used to celebrate a little differently," Vanderport said, "because I was a police officer for 20 years. 420 had a different connotation many years ago, but the last five, I've celebrated it the way it should be celebrated, with family and the great plant that Mother Nature gave us." Illinois legalized the sale and purchase of marijuana on January 1st, 2020, and consuming weed has become more socially acceptable. "In my head, it's no different than going to the bar and having a drink, or, you know, any number of things like that. That certainly doesn't mean people can shirk responsibility for their behavior. Be decent, be responsible, but there shouldn't be any issues with a grown adult having access to this thing." Even before marijuana possession and consumption was legalized, Vanderport thought the laws were antiquated. "When I was a police officer, I thought, this is stupid. Why are we putting young, especially young folks, in jail for marijuana possession? Because you can ruin someone's life with a simple drug charge." Since then, he has seen a shift in public perception, not only from younger generations, but also the elderly. "I've also seen the biggest changes with the cops. In their minds, it's almost just like cigarettes." The Chandler Haig sisters visit Mother Murphy's every 420 for the latest local fare. Every year, they drop a new 420 shirt, and every year the design is sick, said Cassandra Chandler Haag, who was sporting a design from years past. The yearly ritual has become a family endeavor, whose older sister said, "We got two new puppies a couple of years ago, and their first big public outing, we brought them to Mother Murphy's." So Mother Murphy's is very close to our family. Walsh and his co-owners take that responsibility to heart. "We know so many people that have been coming here for many years that love this place. This place has been here for the people, and we're here for the people." Also on the front page, public defender reform advances. Bill to create statewide office passes House and moves to the Senate from Springfield. When Elizabeth Pollock took over as the Champaign County public defender in 2022, one of her team's attorneys was handling 500 cases by herself in a courtroom that should have been staffed by at least three public defenders. That is a recipe for disaster because it's not just taxing on the attorney, but it means that the clients who that attorney is representing are not able to speak with her in a timely fashion. They're not able to review their cases with her in a timely fashion, Pollock said in an interview. "We're talking about months of delay in terms of meeting with attorneys and getting results." With many county public defender offices pushed to the limits throughout Illinois, state lawmakers are moving forward on legislation to create a statewide public defender office. Many public defender offices in Illinois, especially in rural areas, are in desperate need of resources to provide adequate defense services. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1963 on Gideon v. Wainwright that anyone accused of a crime has a right to a defense attorney, setting the basis for public defenders that judges often assign to defendants to represent a person for free. In 2021, a report commissioned by the Illinois Supreme Court examined nine counties of various sizes and found each one lacked necessary resources to provide defendants proper legal representation because of high caseloads, a lack of state oversight, and long wait times to obtain a lawyer. A task force created after that report recommended Illinois fully fund public defense services and establish a statewide office that provides administrative oversight and resources. Demand for public defense attorneys has increased in the last 2 years since the Pretrial Fairness Act took effect in 2023. That law requires more in-depth evidence and arguments during first appearance hearings than under the old bond system, where first appearance hearings often lasted just a few minutes while a judge set a bond. Now detention hearings are required to take place within 72 hours of arrest, meaning public defender services are often needed right away to review early evidence in cases. Legislation in front of the General Assembly would create the Office of State Public Defender, which would primarily be responsible for providing public defender offices around the state with more resources. House Bill 3363 passed the House last week on a 72-41 vote. It now heads to the Senate, where President Don Harmon has tried to pass similar legislation in recent years. Illinois has already established similar offices to improve other aspects of criminal court processes, including the Office of State Appellate Defender and the Office of Statewide Pretrial Services. If lawmakers approve the bill, the office may provide public defense services, but not for several years. Over the first few years, the office's primary responsibility would be to assess the needs of public defenders in Illinois and collect data about their workloads. "We are really lacking any type of data gathering across public defender offices in the state of Illinois because we just have never had the resources to really even count the number of cases that we have." The data gathered would guide decision-making about where the money should be spent and what types of resources, from more attorneys to case investigators, public defender offices should receive. The state has appropriated $10 million for public defense services via a fund established in 2023. State funding would provide greater equity for public defenders throughout the state, which typically receive funding from their counties. County by county, the budget depends on what that county can provide, and some counties don't have as much revenue as others, and so they just simply cannot afford to provide the resources that the public defenders need to do their jobs. Limited data shows all Illinois counties need more public defenders. According to an analysis of county public defender budgets compiled by Northwestern University, no Illinois counties have sufficient staffing in public defender offices. Some positions in public defender offices aren't filled at all, including 83% of counties that don't have any investigators in public defender offices, according to researchers. Most other states also have some level of state oversight and are the primary funding resource for public defenders. Illinois doesn't fall into either category. The bill would require counties to bump up salaries for public defenders from 90 to 95% of a state's attorney's salary, something proponents say will help improve recruitment and retention. Another key provision of the bill would change how public defenders are selected. Outside of Cook County, top county judges appoint or remove public defenders. Under the bill, a local nominating committee would be tasked with appointing or removing public defenders, which is designed to give the public defenders more independence from the judiciary. You're now arguing in front of a judge who hires you and a judge who fires you, potentially. Whereas a state's attorney is an elected official and a judge has no power over him or her and no power over their budget. Chief judges could still be part of the local committees appointing public defenders, however, but their voice would be one of between 4 and 6 members of the commission that selects a county's public defender. Other local commission members would include attorneys, representatives of law schools, or legal professional organizations and former public defender clients. For now, that process would not be required for counties with fewer than 35,000 people, as those counties typically rely on contract attorneys for public defense that split their time in multiple counties. State law currently doesn't require those smaller counties, which account for more than half of the state's 102 counties, to have public defender offices. Cook County already has its own appointment process different from the rest of the state. The problem is the appearance of impropriety. We have a system right now in Illinois and in America where defendants and people who are in the system are starting to have some real questions about the fairness of the system. Pollock explained that it makes sense that judges are part of the process because they see the attorneys perform in the courtroom and might be able to tell who would make a good public defender. But the problem is that it could create an appearance for defendants that their public defender might change how they represent someone to make their boss, the chief judge, happy. Former Madison County public defender John Radowski disagreed. The judges are in the best position to know the local landscape and know the local bench, know the local climate, and pick the person who should furnish those services. Rakowski and the Illinois State Bar Association are proposing that judges continue appointing the public defender, but the commission has the power to remove the public defender or reappoint him to a new term. Rabowski said limiting the judge's power over public defenders to just their first appointment removes any possibility of some kind of retribution or intimidation. The bill is likely to go through more changes as it heads to the Senate for consideration. White House proposal would cut all funding to Head Start. The Trump administration asked Congress to eliminate funding for Head Start, a move that would cut early education for more than 500,000 of the nation's neediest children and child care for their families. The proposal is tucked in a 64-page internal draft budget document obtained by the Associated Press that seeks deep cuts at the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees Head Start. It is still in a highly preliminary phase as the White House prepares to send Congress its budget request for the 2026 fiscal year. It is not clear if lawmakers will accept the proposed cuts. While Congress often ignores a president's budget request, the proposed elimination of Head Start highlights the administration's priorities as Trump seeks to overhaul education in the United States. The budget does not fund Head Start, according to the draft. It says eliminating the program is consistent with the Trump administration's goals of returning control of education to the states and increasing parental control. The federal government should not be in the business of mandating curriculum, locations, and performance standards for any form of education. Spokespeople for Health and Human Services did not respond to a request for comment. Since taking office in January, Trump vowed to dismantle the Department of Education, banned diversity initiatives at schools, and froze funding at several elite universities in an attempt to force change at colleges that Republicans say are hotbeds of liberalism and anti-Semitism. Head Start operates in all 50 states. Parents who otherwise would not be able to afford childcare rely on it when they work or go to school. Supporters say that underscores the importance of Head Start to the economy and at-risk children alike. The program already was hit this year by layoffs and funding lags, along with a glitch this winter that briefly locked preschool providers out of their federal accounts. The private and public schools that run Head Start classrooms are deeply reliant on federal money, and this year's funding problems caused some preschools to close temporarily. Those closures cut off child care for hundreds of thousands of low-income families for whom a day without work is often a day without pay. The National Head Start Association said it was deeply alarmed by the administration's proposal to stop funding the six-decade-old program. It reflects a divestment in our future, Yasmin Vinci, executive director, said in a statement on Thursday. Eliminating funding for Head Start would be catastrophic. It would be a direct attack on our nation's most at-risk children, their well-being, and their families. Head Start is more than just a preschool program, she said. It provides meals and health screenings and helps level the playing field for children who might otherwise fall behind before starting kindergarten. Many Head Start children are in foster care or are homeless. The federal government distributed $1.6 billion for Head Start from January 1st through Tuesday, compared with $2.55 billion issued during the same period last year. Murray said the Trump administration slow-walked the funding appropriated by Congress. This administration believes we cannot afford to help families get preschool or help kids get basic health services, but we can afford trillions of dollars more in tax breaks for billionaires. It's offensive and just plain wrong, and let me be clear, Democrats won't let a proposal like this go anywhere in Congress. But that doesn't mean Head Start and so many other programs aren't under grave threat, because Trump has proven he'll ignore our laws and do whatever he can to break these programs on his own. While Head Start employed bipartisan support since its creation under President Johnson's War on Poverty, some Republicans emphasized its shortcomings and criticized efforts to increase funding. Project 2025, the policy blueprint created by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, called for eliminating Head Start. From the local page, four from Wisconsin killed in plane crash in East Central Illinois. From Trilla, four people from Wisconsin were killed in a small plane crash Saturday morning along the Coles-Cumberland County line. Names were being withheld pending family notification for the two men and two women from Menominee, Wisconsin, according to the Coles County Sheriff's Office. The Sheriff's Office said the investigation remained active and was being conducted by the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board. The crash took place around 10:15 a.m. along East County Road 1000 north between US 45 and the unincorporated community of Trilla, about 9 miles south of Mantoon. The Trilla resident Kurt Goldstein said he was driving home on County Road 1400 north when he encountered the crash scene, and was shocked when he saw an airplane wing and realized it was an airplane in the roadway. The road was impassable. You couldn't get through it, Goldstein said, adding that the plane had struck power lines as it hit the ground. The airplane was just shattered. Goldstein said he saw the remains of two fatalities of the airplane crash and later was told two others on the plane lost their lives. He said his mother, who lives nearby, heard a sputtering sound before the impact of the crash. The crash also caused power outages in nearby Trilla. About 80 customers were without power for several hours Saturday, according to Ameren, Illinois, but power was restored by early Saturday evening. Governor Pritzker reacted to the crash on his Facebook page, stating, "Terrible news out of Coles County. My administration is monitoring the situation as we keep those impacted by the plane crash in our thoughts today. Thank you to the first responders who rushed to the scene. Please follow the guidance of officials as they provide assistance." And prison officers treated for possible drug exposure, from Thompson. 15 corrections officers at the Thompson Federal Prison were sent to local hospitals on Wednesday, April 16th, after they were exposed in the prison mailroom to what is believed to be a dangerous drug. John Zucker, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 4070, said the officers were treated with Narcan and rushed to the hospital. One of the officers had received two doses of Narcan before being sent to the hospital. By late Wednesday afternoon, all of the officers had been released from the hospital and were recovering at home. FCI Thompson is in the Carroll County in northwestern Illinois. The prison is a low-security federal correctional institution with an adjacent minimum security satellite camp and houses 2,041 male inmates, according to the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. All visiting at the prison is suspended until further notice, according to the U.S. Bureau of Prisons website. The exposure marks the eighth incident of staff hospitalization from drug exposure at the Thompson facility in the past 15 months. U.S. Representative Sorensen visited the prison Wednesday afternoon to address safety concerns and said there is the need for stronger preventative measures to keep harmful substances out of federal facilities. He said during a news conference Wednesday afternoon that chemical analysis will be done to determine if the substance is fentanyl. "My prayers are with the Thompson Prison correctional officers who were exposed to possibly dangerous drugs or substances, and I am currently in touch with officials at the prison to assess the situation." He described the exposure as a hazardous material situation, and he plans to meet with the prison's warden. Zumker said union leaders are calling the escalation of potential drug exposure incidents a nationwide safety emergency, and that prison overdose rates have increased in recent years as drug traffickers increasingly target federal facilities through mail systems. The Thompson incident also follows last week's drug exposure of 10 staff members at Federal Correctional Complex in Victorville, California. As a result, AFGE Local 4070 is calling for an immediate halt to all incoming prison mail until proper trafficking prevention measures can be implemented. "The mail system remains the primary route for drugs entering our facilities. Without proper screening measures, we're gambling with our officers' lives," Zumker said. A House Bill 1046, the Mark Fisher Memorial Interdiction of Fentanyl in Postal Mail at Federal Prisons Act, would establish mandatory comprehensive protocols for screening legal mail. And from the Middle East, inquiry shows failures. Israel fires deputy commander over deaths of 15 Palestinian medics from Jerusalem. An Israeli investigation into the killings of 15 Palestinian medics last month in Gaza by Israeli forces said Sunday it found a chain of professional failures and a deputy commander has been fired. The shootings outraged many in the international community, with some calling the killings a war crime. Medical workers have special protection under international humanitarian law. The International Red Cross, Red Crescent, called it the deadliest attack on its personnel in 8 years. Israel at first claimed that the medics' vehicles did not have emergency signals on when troops opened fire, but later backtracked. Cell phone video recovered from one medic contradicted Israel's initial account. Footage shows the ambulance's headlights flashing and logos visible as they pulled up to help another ambulance that earlier came under fire. The military investigation found that the deputy battalion commander acted under the incorrect assumption that all the ambulances belonged to Hamas militants. It said the deputy commander, operating under poor night visibility, felt his troops were under threat when the ambulances sped toward their position and medics rushed out to check the victims. The military said the flashing lights were less visible on night vision drones and goggles. The ambulances immediately came under a barrage of gunfire that went on for more than 5 minutes with brief pauses. Minutes later, soldiers opened fire at a UN car that stopped at the scene. 8 Red Crescent personnel, 6 civil defense workers, and UN staffer were killed in the shootings before dawn on March 23rd by troops conducting operations in Tel al-Sultan, a district of the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Troopers bulldozed over the bodies along with their mangled vehicles, burying them in a mass grave. UN and rescue workers were only able to reach the site a week later. The Israeli military said soldiers buried the bodies to prevent them from being mangled by stray dogs and coyotes until they could be collected, and that the ambulances were moved to allow the route to be used for civilian evacuations. The investigation found that the decision to crush the ambulances was wrong, but said there was no attempt to conceal the shootings. The head of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society has said the men were targeted at close range. Night vision drone footage provided by the military shows soldiers were 20 to 30 yards away from the ambulances. The deputy commander was the first to open fire. The investigation found the paramedics were killed due to an operational misunderstanding by Israeli forces. FSU classes to resume, but attendance optional, from Tallahassee, Florida. Classes will resume at Florida State University today, 4 days after a deadly shooting on campus that left 2 people dead and 6 others injured. Students and instructors will have the option of holding classes remotely or in person. The school waived all mandatory attendance policies that could affect grades, so students won't be punished if they choose not to go to class in person. Students also can request an incomplete grade for their class if they feel they are unable to complete a course. We want everyone to receive the support and help they need. For some students, that may mean not going back into the classroom. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, April 21st. Please stay tuned.